Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, students. That's good, thank you. This is a compliment to all of you. You're just like medical students. No one wants to sit near the front of the hall. So if those of you who are brave and want to see the pictures better, there's lots of room in front. Don't be shy. Come on down. Makes it a little more intimate. I am Abe Fuchs from the Faculty of Medicine. I am delighted once again to welcome all of you to this mini health science series lecture. Again, as I asked you the week before, how many of you are CGEP students? Raise a hand. Wonderful. High school students? Fantastic. That's a very nice split. And we're very pleased that both groups are here on campus to join us. Those of you who may not know should be aware of the fact that all the PowerPoint presentations of our speakers are available on the website. Also, the articles that you may wish to read for interest and your education are also available, so please take advantage of those and be part of the greater education community. I know you have lots of homework at CGEP in high school, but if you want to learn something a little extra and you have the time and your interest is piqued by the lectures, by all means, look at that material. Tonight, we're really delighted to have a very special speaker and my colleague, Dr. David Mulder. Dr. Mulder has been at McGill since the early 1960s. After he graduated from the College of Medicine in Saskatchewan, where he is from, he then trained in surgery, came here to McGill, and as they say, worked his way up from being a resident right up to being the Rock Robertson Professor of Surgery and the earliest named chair in surgery, or the second after the Archibald, or was it the other way around? The second. Dr. Mulder's specialty is cardiac and thoracic surgery, but he's also been a pioneer in the development of trauma surgery, which you'll hear about in a little while. Trauma refers to accidents, injuries, whether those are after an earthquake or, as you will see, on a playing field, football or hockey. Dr. Mulder has been head of the Department of Surgery and chairman of that department. He's been head of the Department of Surgery at the Montreal General Hospital. He was director of cardiothoracic surgery. He has an enormous experience in that area, but also a lot of experience in working overseas as an advisor to governments and other ministries of health who wish to organize trauma services. And you'll hear what I think a level one trauma center is and what it means from Dr. Mulder's talk. But what most people know who are not in the medical field is that Dr. Mulder has been for many years the physician-in-chief to the Montreal Canadiens. And that has brought him even more fame in some circles than his work in trauma surgery. And that led to him being a consultant to the NHL, to the World Cup. He was president of an association, it's an interesting one, it's an association of physicians who work with NHL teams, and Dr. Mulder was chairman of that as well. He is very interested in teaching young people about both aspects, how to prevent trauma, how to deal with it, how to help governments, and it's fascinating to learn how you help a city, for example, get ready for something you hope never happens, such as a major explosion or a major fire or whatever. But the second area is even more interesting to all of us today because we read about trauma on the football field, we read about lawsuits in the NFL, and we read about settlements. We read about horror stories about football players dying at the age of 55 from dementia, and when their brains are examined, they look fairly bad, and just like a person with dementia who might be 50 or 40 years older. So this is going to be an interesting talk, how you deal with those issues, how you protect yourself, how do we deal with it, and I'm really looking forward, as I'm sure you are, Dr. Mulder, for all his work, as you will notice from his little lapel pin, is also a member of the Order of Canada. So it's a real treat for us to welcome him here, and let's hear it for...
Thank you very much, Abe. It's a real honor and privilege for me to be with you tonight and talk to you a little bit about some of my experiences as a physician and also as a... what I wanted to emphasize with you tonight is the word collaborative. As in the it used to be, as surgeons, we said the surgeon's the captain of the ship. What I've learned it now, and I learned it as I go along here, from my experience as a hockey player, and looking after many athletic teams, as I'm going to show you. But you know, every time we give a lecture now for scientific purposes, we have to make disclosures as to whether we've received any funding or any we have any things in our cupboard. So what I'm going to tell you tonight, and you maybe won't believe this, I don't have a piece of paper or a qualification as a sports physician. I didn't have a residence in it. My real job, as Abe has said, is a thoracic surgeon, and I have a specific interest in trauma. Well, how do I justify being here tonight? Well, I guess you could say my father would probably tell me I was a graduate of the School of Hard Knocks, and that's probably true. But everything I've done in sports medicine, I've enjoyed. I've never considered it work. And I really began in sports medicine with two important mentors. And I think in this day and age, there's nothing more important than mentorship. I'm going to outline that. Then I was privileged to begin work in September of 1963. I was a surgical resident. We were broke, and Dr. Kinnear offered me a job to be the cut man for the Montreal Junior Canadiens. So I got to sew up all the lacerations on a Sunday afternoon. They filled the old Montreal Forum. It was an incredible experience. Three of us did it together. One of them was Willie Keon, who is now Senator Keon, and the other was Tony Paparaitis. And we also had the McGill Redmond to work with. And they taught me two important things. First of all, there are three life-threatening injuries that we, as a team physician, you had to be aware of. And they're listed as 1, 2, 3. And they said, of course, you probably won't ever see these in your career, but you've got to be ready for them. You've got to be, well, of course, now I've seen them all in spades. So the first thing is, and we used to walk around the McGill field with a great big needle in case somebody got an injury to the airway, so we'd give them a substitute for breathing. And then we had drills for bleeding and looking after brain injuries. The other important lesson that they suggested is that you all know a doctor-patient relationship. They taught us about a doctor-player relationship and the emotions that go through a hockey player or football player or soccer player's mind when they get an injury, the threat that it implies, and so on. Well, I'm a great believer that sports have a broader impact on our lives than just what you read about in the newspaper. I should have had another to the first point there. Sports should be fun, and that's the first lesson, but they should also be safe, and I should have put that up there. But I also think team sports gives us a discipline towards a common goal. It certainly established a work ethic. I guess one of the things I learned playing hockey was the discipline involved. And playing hockey and trying to be a medical student was doubly hard. But it established a work ethic and a time management system that I didn't have before. And then maybe more important than anything, it taught me a respect for my teammates. Well, you say, how on earth does that apply to you as a surgeon? Well, you know what I think of now? Tomorrow morning, I've got four big operations to do. I think of every operation as a team sport. I can't do the operation without a good anesthetist to put the patient to sleep, with an outstanding scrub nurse, with a whole the people in the recovery room to look after them, the nurses who stay up all night and look after them. So to me, I learned from sports about the value of team sports. Bobby Orr I met in 1963. And this is the cover of the Costco magazine this week, just so it's absolutely au courant. And he wrote a book about his, it's called My Story. And you'll see there he talks about playing the game and life the right way. I've had the enormous privilege of fishing with Bobby Orr every summer, and he taught me how to fly fish. But most of all, he taught me about his feelings about hockey and about a team sport. And he and I agree on most things, but as I'm going to show you now, and I talked to him the other day, he thinks we should keep fighting in the hockey game, and I'm opposed to that. We've had our bitter arguments, and I'm going to tell you why I think that. Well, these are some general points that I wanted to go over with you related to my experience as a team doctor, as a caring for athletes for quite a long period of time. Each one of these I could probably give you a one-hour talk on in terms of the things that have changed. When I started with the Montreal Junior Canadiens, they didn't wear helmets, they didn't have a mask, they didn't wear mouth guards. The first year I was with the Montreal Junior Canadiens, we had three young, promising athletes who lost their eye. It changed their lives and their careers considerably. And a fellow in Toronto, a Dr. Tom Ashby, he suggested that we should that everybody should wear a full facial mask. And so over the time, the equipment has evolved enormously. I'm really proud this year that the NHL has mandated that any new junior player that comes in addition to helmet, must wear a visor down to the tip of his nose. So improved equipment has really changed the game and has changed the injuries we see. Whereas the first game that I looked after at the old form, I probably put in 50 stitches. Now there's no stitching at all in junior hockey, and we get a little bit with the pros. The next important thing I think has, and this is where I talk about collaboration, the advances in medical imaging are nothing short of sensational. And it used to be we took an old plain x-ray. Now we can do a CT scan, we can do a PET scan, we can do an MRI, we can do an MRI with contrast. So Bobby Orr had 7 operations on the left knee and 5 operations on the right knee, and now has 2 knee replacements, because his surgeons didn't know what they were operating on. So they made a big slice in his knee, took out a cartilage, when nowadays we could, with the sophisticated medical imaging, we could tell exactly what the lesion was, and then we could have minimally invasive surgery with a scope, so very little damage to the rest of the joint. And we could have saved Bobby Orr from 2 knee replacements. The other thing is now we're able to measure defects, so we can do tailored physiotherapy and very specific rehab based on a really accurate scientific measurement. The other thing that that I think is particularly important is the development of formal organizations with standards of care. So what does that mean? Well, if, for instance, in the NHL, when we decided to form a group of team physicians, and Dr. Kinnear, again, was one of the leaders, the general manager of the Montreal Canadiens was Sam Pollock. He says, I'm opposed to that because if the players have too many doctors around, they'll be sick and they won't want to play. But anyway, finally we organized things, and with my experience in trauma, we were able to set standards so that today it's mandated across every National Hockey League team that there be two doctors present at every game, that they have immediate access to the ice surface, they're 25 feet from an emergency clinic which has standard equipment, they know how to handle the airway, they're ATLS trained. So I've taken my trauma experience and established standards throughout the league. We now have an electronic health record that is far better than any at McGill, than any at the Montreal General Hospital, so that every single athlete, whether he comes from Los Angeles or Calgary, I can plug into the computer and I can find out every injury he's had, what he's allergic to, and the advances have been impressive. But as Dr. Fuchs said, and as you read as early as November 4th, Health Canada made a major grant to look at the diagnosis and management of concussions. People have referred to concussions as the elephant in the room, and this book, A League of Denial, explains why the NFL had to settle their class action settlement. And if any of you are real sports fanatics, you'll enjoy reading this by two very good writers. And they talk about the Mike Webster, who was the center for the Pittsburgh Steelers, and how he went from being an outstanding class athlete to becoming a demented man who committed suicide. And his brain was one of the first to be examined, and they discovered that in his brain he had damage to the, he had atrophy, but he also had an abnormal protein, LAU protein, which I think is maybe going to help us sort this problem out. This is the fourth point there, though, the fact that our own McGill Scott Delaney has noted in young people in Canada who play soccer and are heading the ball that they have already got some degree of damage in terms of concussions. So what I'm going to talk to you about today is our head injuries and the major impact that they've had and what I think the problem is, and I've summarized it in that line there. We have no metrics, we have no x-ray, we have no way of establishing a good diagnosis for concussion, and therefore we don't treat it well, and I'll try and show you that. Well, just to put things into perspective, and again to bridge my trauma and my athletic world, the big picture of trauma, I think it's maybe the neglected disease in modern society. It's the commonest cause of death up to the age of 45 in Canada. And brain injury contributes to 50% of those deaths. And the fact that these people are all young, most of them males, so that if you look at it as man years life lost, that trauma exceeds cancer and heart disease put together. It's a phenomenal problem. These are young wage earners, and as you can see there, the vast majority of youths die in car accidents in Canada, and we see that every week that I'm on call for trauma, I see it. But the bottom line is that there's still athletic injury and traumatic brain injury is an important factor, not so much in mortality as in morbidity. Those of you who are hockey fans will know whose helmet this is. You know that hockey players sometimes go down on their lay down and block a shot. This is Josh George's helmet, and he laid down in front of a shot, probably 90 or 100 miles an hour. And you can, I took this picture, cracked his helmet, as you can see. But look at the mark of the puck on the helmet. But that doesn't tell the whole story. Underneath this, when we walked him off, the helmet had cracked and opened his skull, and he had a concussion, and he was out of play for a significant period of time after this. And that's the nature of the game. So there's a whole spectrum of head injury. The three bottom ones are more common in car accidents or falls, and they're very important. But what I wanted to talk to you about tonight is our concussions. And the word mild traumatic brain injury has appeared in the literature, and people talk about it as related to a Glasgow Coma Scale. And the Glasgow Coma Scale is a numeric way of measuring injury to the brain. Normal is 15. That means you're talking and doing, you really have a normal situation. So people have said that Glasgow Coma Scale of 13 to 15 with mild changes in consciousness is called minor traumatic brain injury. Well, I don't think there is anything that you can call minor traumatic. If you have a brain injury, it's a bad problem. But concussion is separate from this, and I'm going to try and show you that. These are the sports that you see concussion in. It doesn't take any imagination to know that hockey and football are the two commonest. There's a broad spectrum of clinical presentation, which I'm going to show you. All of them have some acute symptoms, and I want you to pay special attention to the second impact syndrome. And this is, you'll have read in the newspapers, in the last 2 weeks, a young football player in New England had a concussion and then a second hit 2 weeks later, died that night from a major brain injury. And then post-concussion syndrome, I'm going to try and tell you a little bit about it. Well, this is why Bobby Orr and I disagree. I've always thought of boxing and fighting, that the goal of a fight or the goal of boxing was to produce a concussion, to knock the other guy out. And sure enough, what happened here is that this was the Whitby Dunlops. This is a real video from the Bell Center. But you can see this is Richard Zednik. And remember I told you there were three injuries. One was a head injury, one was injury to the airway. Here you can see Zednik down on the ice, and you'll see the trainer's uniform signal if you watch TV, is when he puts his fist up in the air, he wants the doctor. Now watch, I want you to watch the injury. What caused that injury? The thing that caused that injury is a great big elbow pad. When I played hockey, I had a little leather elbow pad. He has he has an elbow pad that is it's made of plastic. It's huge. It's a weapon. So there, the signal goes up. They want the doctor to come out. And so this is what we're trained to do in trauma. And now we have to do it in front of the not only the audience here, but the audience in the Bell Center. And we invoke our training as trauma surgeons. And we, you can see there, I gave the universal signal. But you see what caused that injury is the elbow, is the elbow pad. And you can see his helmet did stay on. And the man who lost his life in Whitby, played for the Whitby Dunlops, his helmet, probably his strap was loose, and his helmet came off. I'm not going to go through the whole video here. We'll go on. And this man, Zednik, interesting thing, you remember my three lessons that my mentors taught me about spinal cord injury and brain injury and bleeding. Well, you remember that Richard Zednik was the guy who got his carotid artery slashed due to a skate cut to the neck in Buffalo not so long ago. So Here's the what people have agreed upon as a discussion as a definition of concussion, and I think that's pretty straightforward. It's a thing about concussion. It's probably a functional thing rather than an anatomic thing. So all the best scans in the world that we have now don't show anything. And Richard Zednik, who is obviously flat unconscious on the ice, woke up about a minute or two later, and he had absolutely no findings on a CT scan of his brain, but he had fractured facial bones, fractured nose, and an injury to his C-spine, so associated injuries. The other thing I want you to note here is that, in contrast to what everybody says, as you can see, helmets don't prevent concussion all the time. Now, there's a lot of discussion about whether it's what they call a jiggle of the brain, or think of the brain like a bowl full of jello in a box, which is thick bone of the skull. And these are the other important thing to remember is that sometimes you don't even have to have a blow to the head or face. You can have a blow to the shoulder and have like a whiplash, and that will produce a concussion. And you can see that a very many of the concussions or the neurologic symptoms resolve in a very short period of time. And to me, the fact that this is a functional disturbance makes it more difficult to measure. And the fact that we can't often find any structural deformity on the very best scans that we have today is I think, a real challenge. These are the kind of symptoms that you can have. They're anything from somatic or to cognitive in terms of your brain function. Emotional, it can present as an acute depression, an acute athlete, and this is very rare in an athlete. It can have physical signs. It can be changes in behavior, and something as simple as just. And when we get the people who've had a potential concussion, we get them in a room and we do what we call now a SCAT exam. And this, we do a complete neurologic, but so we could have some comparative and so we could all be on the same page, we do now what's called, as some people call it, a sideline concussion assessment tool. People call it a sports concussion assessment. But these are just some basic principles that we employ. And remember associated injuries. You can see this is Andrei Kosichin. He's got had his face smashed into the boards. And you can just see the look on his face that he isn't in the same world as we are. And he gradually recovered, but you can see under his eye there, he's got a big mouth, and he had a fracture of the maxillary bone there. And he also had a whiplash injury as well. So remember associated injuries. This is a tool so we could all get better in communicating with one another and to try and put a numeric value on a concussion or a brain injury. And we pushed very hard to make this happen through the NHL team physicians. And so now you'll see the NHL has enforced when there's someone gets a suspicious hit or a concussion, they all have to be taken away from the bench into a dressing room to a quiet area, and we do this sports concussion assessment tool. And we come out with a numerical number, which we put into a computer, and it's on their record. Remember what I said about the doctor-player relationship? Well, now the players are very sensitive about being labeled as having a concussion, so they say, "Doc, don't put the C word down." Don't, and you know, you used to think they were talking about cancer, but they're talking about a concussion because it has implications when they're dealing with their next contract. It has implications, as I'll show you in a minute, on other things. These are some of the things that we put them through. We ask them to list, say where what city they're in, who scored the last goal, and so on. But then we ask them to repeat the months in reverse order. We have a set of cognition that we check for, and then we exercise, and we make them do push-ups, or we have them run work on a bike in the dressing room, before we let them go back on the ice. This is kind of like the police do when they're looking for doing a sobriety check. We look at balance and we make them walk the line, toe heel along a straight line on the floor, which we have in the dressing room. And then we have them do the hand-eye coordination. And these are all part of the sideline assessment. The NHL did a study, and this was done by Benson from Calgary. And we looked at what kind of symptoms were associated with concussion. And you can see these are just exactly what you might expect. And it gives the prevalence, and I guess we've seen all of them. And these are the, in terms of the findings and subsequent findings, and I'll talk about modifiers in a minute, but you can see amnesia, loss of consciousness there, and blurred vision. These are the common symptoms. One of the single most important organizations has been the Zurich International Symposium, and it meets every 2 years. A group of docs, many of them are from the NHL, but many of them are researchers, many of them are pathologists, neurologists, sports medicine doctors, and so on. And they look at changing the, and they meet every 2 years. So the latest one has been was held this summer, and the vast majority of concussions will settle in a week. And that's why there are so many snake oil salesmen around who come and say they've got the latest cure for concussions, and they'll try and sell it to an NHL team or to a poor player. And anything works, rest works, cures most of them in 85% of the case. But it's the ones that are more serious that we're really interested in. The key thing is the modifiers. I'll show you those in a moment. The bottom line is that I keep coming back to is we don't know how to measure concussion. We don't have a good diagnostic test. We don't know how to treat the patients. We don't have any set time when they can return to play. So a lack of metrics continues to be an amazing problem. In terms of modifiers, these are things that go along with an injury that have a negative impact on the outcome. And if they've lost consciousness for more than a minute, that means they're going to be out for a long time. Amnesia is important. Recent or frequent concussion and age and gender. For instance, if you're 35 or older and have repeated concussions, they don't get better as quickly as if you're 14 or 15. Females tend to have a higher, injury to obtain the same degree of concussion. And then, of course, if you're on any medications, it's important. This is the consensus conference on treatment, and as I said, we don't really have a good, our only treatment is rest. And so we have them at physical rest, emotional rest. We don't let them use computers, cell phones. We discourage televisions. Sort of one of the guys said to me, you want me just to go home and sleep in the dark? And I said, yeah, that's about it. We don't have any treatment. We don't have any drug. We don't have any medications, so the bottom line that I keep coming back to is we don't have a metric, we don't have a measure, and that's what I'm going to challenge you with today. So what we do, we rest them until they don't have any symptoms, and then we put them on a bike, and we ride them, get them to get their heart rate up to over 100. And if they don't have any symptoms, then we go on and let them go on the ice or on the football field, whatever the sport is. And then we move them up to practice. And each stepwise, they have to remain asymptomatic until they get up to a contact practice, and then we let them return to play. And when they get to this stage, then we administer a neuropsychologic testing. And this just reemphasizes the stepwise play. So the important thing that we've learned is while the neuropsych testing, and the NHL was the first league to introduce neuropsych testing for every player as they entered, and they do it as soon as they make the NHL. We get a baseline neuropsych testing. So whenever they have a concussion, they have to return to that. We use that as a guideline as to when their level, and this is when they're ready to play. And this is really the first metric, and it's still very soft. And of course, the player. Remember the advice I had about a doctor-player relationship. Players do everything to get back in the lineup. They stretch the truth. They want to play. And so the big question is the return to play, and how do we deal with it? How do we deal with a hockey game? I mean, as late as last night, one of our guys got hurt. He says, "Doc, I'm okay. I can." And the coach says, "You know, count fingers. Can you see one or two fingers?" And these are some of the brief guidelines, but we don't do it very well. And this is what this slide tells us. So if we had a player that we evaluated, and all good intentions, we evaluate them and let them go back the same day, we make the wrong decision 25% of the time. 25% of them are, or 26% are out more than 10 days. And so if they stay in the game, if they lie to us or they don't reveal that they've had a concussion, 14% are out. And if we remove them from the game, they're still... So we don't have a good metric. We don't have a surefire way. So neuropsych testing is the first tool we've had in terms of judging return to play. And as I said, in order to use that, they have to be asymptomatic through this stepwise series of tests. And I guess this is from Mark Aubrey in Ottawa, and I think that's good advice. If you're not sure, then you, when in doubt, sit them out. And that, I think, particularly implies to hockey coaches who are looking after our young people today. Now, we talked about prevention, we talked about mouth guards, helmets, face masks. These have all really revolutionized. You know what the biggest problem is when we came to introduce the electronic health record? We couldn't convince the NHL that it was important to them for each team to put up $30,000 or $50,000 to implement the system. But when we, when every player finishes their NHL career, they always present their club with a bill about dental injuries. And just the fact that sometimes people are traded and we don't know who's responsible for what injury or when it occurred, that's what allowed them to. We saved that the money on the dental bills and it was sufficient to implement the electronic health record. Well, if you see the first three there, that all relates to concussion prevention related to equipment. And that, but there are other important things that I'll show you when I show you the last visit, like the boards, the arena, ice standards, the ice conditions. I think maybe one of the most important things are the rules and regulations. And then what I tried to show you in that first video is that the protective device for the elbow really became the weapon for the injury in terms of concussion. So... And I think when the and we've talked a lot about this in the league, when the protective equipment becomes a weapon or changes your aspect in terms of your safety or your ability to protect yourself, it's a serious problem. Well, these are some of the early and late complications or consequences of concussion. I think it, particularly in young people, if you have young children playing, is there's any doubt that they've had a concussion, you keep them out. Because this, in my mind, the second impact syndrome is based on the fact that they're returned to play far too early, and a second injury has a very major impact. Then there's the post-concussion syndrome. And you have to understand that these are fairly infrequent. But when they do occur, they're very serious. You can have depression, you can have epilepsy, all. But now what we have learned about in the NFL players and what settled this suit is what they're now calling CTE, or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or what Muhammad Ali, the boxer, has. They call that dementia pugilistica, or Parkinson's disease. These are all neurological consequences late of concussion. So here's the reality. It doesn't matter what paper you've read in the last 2 weeks, if you watch CNN or if you watch TSN, everybody's worried about concussion. Tony Dorsett is now going to sue the NFL. They've already settled for $800 million. But what bothers me is that there's some, we're seeing more and more of it as our young people are playing sports, and we're unable to make an accurate diagnosis, and we have a real difficulty with establishing prevention across all levels of play. This is the reality in terms of how this impacts the individual, and I think doctor-player relationship is the most important thing. So it has an acute and a long-term effect. We've had several players where we've counseled that they must cease playing competitive sports, and it's the hardest thing you can do as a team physician to make this suggestion. But the team, the management, are on our backs all the time. They lose a skilled player, and they, I talked to the people from Tampa Bay last night, and you know that Steven Stamkos broke his tibia, and he's out 3 months. So that means they've got to replace a $5 million player. So the economic impact on the player, team, and the NHL, and there probably isn't any bigger problem now in terms of the medical legal implications, and the NFL just settled a class action suit based on this unraveling of that story, a league of denial. And then what subliminally, I think, affects all of our young people is they all want to emulate their heroes on the ice, whether it's P.K. Subban or somebody else, and so they want to behave like they do. Ken Dryden was the smartest hockey player that I've ever had anything to do with, and the other guys were reading comic books or trash magazines. He was reading Winston Churchill's War and Peace. He's a great writer, and in September of 2011, he wrote an editorial in the Toronto Globe and Mail and said it was time for the NHL to get heads smart, in other words, to wake up in terms of how we're managing the concussions. And these are some of the factors that he mentioned, and suggested to the world and to the authorities that we move in this direction. This is an editorial from the Canadian Medical Association Journal, and I think has frightened an enormous number of people. This is exactly the title: Hockey Concussions, Is It Child Abuse? And it was written by two very responsible pediatricians. And these are some of the things that I still worry about. The fact that in 2005 there were 800,000 children or kids registered in amateur hockey. 2011 there were 507. So it's almost a 20% drop. Parents taking them out of organized sports because of risk of concussion. And then the Ontario legislation has passed very strict guidelines for coaches, teachers, and so on, in terms of concussion care. And body checking now is at various levels has been blocked. And what their bottom line was is failure to implement these rigid concussion measures is nothing short of child abuse. I think there's something more to that too. I think We have to find a measurement. We have to know what we're dealing with. We have to know. So we're looking for a metric, and I'll try and show you that. Now, this is Ken Dryden, the hockey player, and you'll all recognize his feeling. And this Saturday, editorial in the Globe and Mail, he took issue with Bobby Orr's book, and he took the same issue that I have with the book, is that Bobby Orr supports the concept that we must keep fighting in the game, and Dryden is was violently opposed. A year ago, at the All-Star Game in Ottawa, all NHL team physicians met. And we, amongst the team physicians, I had arranged to have Stephen Harper speak to the group of physicians. And somebody got word of it, and they suggested that Stephen Harper was too good for the doctors, and so he spoke to the Board of Governors. And that left me a week before the NHL All-Star Game and the docs meeting, a scientific meeting, and I had to find an alternative. So I phoned our old friend David Johnson, who is the Governor General now and was Principal of McGill, was a hockey player. I'd known him a little bit, and I told him the dilemma. He said, I'll fix that up. So he invited every single NHL doctor to his home. We convened in a room. He immediately excluded all the NHL brass. He had doctors on each side, and the wives were all invited. Can you imagine a wife from Atlanta, Georgia, being invited to the Governor General's residence? He had set up the residence so that Lord Stanley was there, the Lady Byng was there. It was absolutely an incredible show, something I'll never forget. He said, look, the solution to this is not more protection. The solution to this is research. And when we left that meeting that Saturday afternoon, we said there had to be increased emphasis on clinical research. And these are the areas that we looked at, some of which we have applied and some are in development. But it really wasn't a big advance. But this is where we decided that the money was, and this is where we decided that that we should work hard on, and that, as he said, you know, the solution to the concussion problem has got to have a McGill approach, and that we've got to it's got to be solved through the problem of basic research. These are some of the things that are going on now in Canada under the neuropathology. The maybe the most action is going on there in Boston under biochemical markers. The most action is going on in Toronto, the Playfair Center, where Charles Tatter is looking at this abnormal protein. There's some genetic studies being done in British Columbia. So Canada is taking a lead on the basis of what David Johnson has suggested. Well, here's our friend Ken Dryden again, and he wrote another editorial. This was in the form of a letter to Gary Bettman. They both went to Cornell together, so they were... They didn't know each other very well at that time. Dryden had moved on, but he made this suggestion, and he suggested that the solution was to create a structure to study concussions, sponsored by the NHL and hosted by the university. And I'm happy to say that the first one of those is going to occur at McGill, and David Johnson's going to help us with it. We're going to have all the team physicians. We're going to have all the elite researchers in the world. We're going to meet at McGill, and we're going to look at the science around concussion. Sometimes something good happens from something bad. This is Max Pacioretty, and you can see that Zdeno Chara, who is, you know, head and shoulders above him, guided his head gently into this, or not so gently, into the stanchion of the boards, and it led to several really important things. Here you see him unconscious on the ice, and we signal and bring the stretcher out. I was worried that maybe he wouldn't wake up again. I sat right behind the bench when this happened, and I'm here, and you can see his head hit the stanchion. So it changed the boards, it changed the stands, and but most of all, it changed our behavior. You can see the white paint, how, you know, from the boards. You can see that his head, he was absolutely out cold on the ice. And but it led to his parents, after he recovered and returned to play, they created the Max Pacioretty Foundation, similar to the Saku Koivu Foundation. And they said they were going to help us raise $3.5 million. and we were going to use it to buy a machine. And sometimes at McGill, we have the enormous potential here. And I talked to an old friend, Albert Aguayo, and I asked him where he thought the money was in terms of trying to elucidate concussion, because I'm not a neurologist, I'm not a neurosurgeon. And he said, you know, I think back to Wilder Penfield and McGill, and he said, I think the money is going to be, the gains are going to be in imaging. And so he suggested that we collaborate with industry, which we've done, and that we develop a world-class research unit using a functional MRI. And so within by next year, we'll have one of four research MRIs in the world. One, and this is, I'm very happy to say, this is going to be a collaborative effort between the Montreal General and the Mass General in Boston. We've had one donor has already given us $1 million. The company that's going to supply the instrument has given us $500,000. And so, and we've had donations from the league, from the Players Association, from the federal government. And so we put together, we'll soon have completed our goal with the help of the foundations to open this unit. And I think that's going to, so after what was a terrible tragedy, We've set up this foundation. Well, just in coming to a close here, these are my simple suggestions for what we need to do, and they're based on a lot of thought. They're very controversial, and Don Cherry would oppose them completely. But I think, as a physician and as a group of NHL physicians, that we've got to adopt the International Ice Hockey Federation that there can be no head hits in hockey. There are no head hits now, or they try to abolish them in the NFL. And I think hockey should be thrown out of, or fighting should be thrown out of hockey at every level. Shouldn't be allowed. And remember, I started my story with a man who had been in a fight in Ontario, not an NHLer, but a senior league, and his helmet came off during the fight. He fell, hit at the back of his head, and split his occiput open, and he died of a brain injury. Remember what I said now, the NHL has mandated visors for everybody who starts in. So I can see a very sneaky way that I'm going to get that this is going to come true, because you see, you can't fight if you have a visor on. And if you throw your visor off, you probably watch the last few, the referees step in and they stop the fight because they don't want you to fall down and hit your head and die. And then the other thing we've been able to accomplish is we've been able to get the NHL to look at shoulder pads, elbow pads, because I think some of these now are used inappropriately as weapons, rather than what they were meant for, and that's protection. And this is maybe most important, is the broad education program for coaches, officials, parents, and every healthcare provider. And last year you'll have read about a death in Edmonton where a player was hit, had a serious head injury, and because he hadn't had the mentorship that I had in terms of wise people looking at the ABCs and maybe not the trauma experience that we have, and he died because of inadequate care at the arena. But I think the answer is, as David Johnson has encouraged us, is the answer is going to come to research, and it's going to come from learning how to image. And I think if we can, perhaps we might even have to do a baseline MRI image, and we'll be able to look at injuries to the axon. We'll be able to come up with a definite metric to look at concussion, and therefore we'll be able to treat it better, and we'll be able to. And Cappy, do they have the slide? This is a marvelous resource that I use for this talk. It's from Paul Eklund in London, Ontario, and he's put together the world's literature on concussion. And if any of you want a resource, it's absolutely incredible. Well, wouldn't you know it, our Prime Minister's gotten into the act. And he's written a very thoughtful book. It's very hard to read. I have to admit I haven't been all the way through it. But he looks at the roots of hockey and of course, those of you who are Montrealers and Quebecers will realize that so much of it started right here in Montreal. But what he talks about is he grew up in Toronto, which I didn't know. I always thought he was a Calgarian. But he grew up in Toronto and I guess moved to Calgary later on. But he talks about the rise of professional hockey. And he covers the rules and regulations very well. And he gets a little sidetracked about the Maple Leafs. In fact, he thinks maybe the Montreal Canadiens spawned the Toronto Maple Leafs, and something I didn't know about. But it's a hard read. But in it, he brings out some of the things that I've tried to talk to you about, the organizational aspects in terms of the medical coverage. And this is Bobby Orr's book, and I got this drawl voice the other night. Knock, he said, how are you? And he said, I'm going to send you a little something in the mail. And he sent me this book, which I've now read, and it's a great read. And any of you who are parents of children who have children playing hockey, you should read it. It talks about very many medical aspects, talks about his injuries to his knee, talks about the sadness that he didn't have the diagnostic imaging that we have today, that he had 7 big operations on his knees rather than a focused approach that we can do nowadays. And if you have parents, it's excellent in terms of advising you about guiding your child through a hockey, an amateur or professional hockey career. He's a hockey agent now. I'm very biased, I think, and I have to tell you one little personal story before I close. Is in 1963, he was playing junior hockey, came into the Montreal Forum, and Dr. Kinnear was with me, and he's a gastroenterologist, and Bobby Orr got a cut on his head and bleeding massively. And in those days, the clinic at the old Forum was covered with battleship linoleum. Of course, it was red, white, and blue, and on the white part of the linoleum was all covered with blood. Anyway, I did my best suturing job, and I think I put 15 stitches in his forehead, which he still tells me was a bad job. But it stopped the bleeding, and in those days, our goal was to get them right out on the ice. We were judged not by our quality of how the patient looked or whether it was a good plastic surgical thing, was how fast did we get them back on the playing surface. So I said, Bobby, get out there, get out. You can get on for the next shift. No, doc, he said. He went to the sink and he got a towel, wet it with water, and he got down his hands and knees and he washed the whole floor. It's never, ever happened to me before. And if you read his book, you'll understand why. But for me, as I said at the beginning, sports medicine has been an odyssey for me. It's been a tremendous opportunity. I think it's a privilege and an honor. And Dr. Kinnear, I was used to when people asked him as a gastroenterologist why he liked to look after hockey, and he said, "Well, it's better than taking antidepressants." And I think that's probably true. Anyway, thank you for your attention.
That's great, David. Thank you so much. There's a lot to talk about. We're going to turn on the lights. I'm going to ask you to write down your questions on cards. You're all used to that. Do you all have pencils? Pens? Write them down and give them to one of the students wearing a red McGill shirt. You bring them down, we'll have a question and answer session. Huh?
I'm not wearing a red
shirt. You give them to a student wearing a red McGill shirt, or my friend Kathy Flanders wearing a black jacket. Okay, a couple of questions. First of all, they want to know whether that was you in the videos.
It was.
It was.
On my hands and knees.
That was absolutely right. Well, here's a very difficult question. What is the most severe, I don't know, it's just year, severe injury? I can't read that.
Let's try that one.
Okay, here's a very nice question. I guess we'll ask what's the most severe injury, and that's a fair question.
That's a very good question. Clearly, the most severe injury that I ever had to deal with was a puck. You saw the puck I showed you that hit the helmet and dented on the plastic of the helmet. The worst injury I ever dealt with a player stopped a slap shot with his larynx and immediately had no airway and couldn't breathe. And it reminded me of Dr. Kinnear and Dr. Percy telling me you had to, so we had to think, do I do a tracheostomy on the ice? Do I do a, what do I do? And I remembered something that an anesthetist had told me about a jaw thrust and a jaw lift. And those of you who have any knowledge about trauma, if you put your hands under the mandible here and lift up, the muscles that are attached to the floor of the mouth are also attached to the larynx. And when he was down on the ice and gasping and turning black, and I thought he was going to die, and my hands on the ice, I did a jaw thrust, and I got the most delightful sound that I ever heard, and that was sort of a wheeze that he was getting some air in. We took him into the clinic, and we tried to intubate him, and I couldn't. So Dr. Fleischer and I held him, his head like that. We called the Montreal General. From the time the puck hit him in the neck until 22 minutes later, we had a tracheostomy done. We did it in the operating room. We had a very skilled anesthetist who met us in the hallway on the 8th floor at the General. He intubated the patient. We operated on, it was the first patient I had ever operated on with his skates on. And when we finished the trach and got him breathing again, he had developed a tension pneumothorax, probably because when we were doing the tracheostomy, we maybe injured the pleura at the top of his lung. So then we had to put a chest tube in, and I always remember the night because everybody thought he died, and so there were more reporters outside the Montreal General Hospital than usual. Anyway, he survived. He lives in Swift Current, Saskatchewan. I still see him in the summertime when I go out there. He didn't ever make it back to playing professional hockey. But he's married, has a wife, and he scouts for the Montreal Canadiens. He has two children, and clearly his life was salvaged.
Wow. There's a happy ending, that's for sure. Here's a very important question. Can a concussion have permanent effects?
Absolutely, and I think that's... And I guess my message here is we don't know how to measure the permanent effects. We don't know how to diagnose the acute effects. But if we knew how to measure the early acute effects, then we could say this guy can't go back to play, or this guy can't return to play for a year, or we had something to measure. Or if we had a clue that would allow us to treat this patient with a medication or hyperbaric oxygen, we've had all sorts of suggestions. McGill has, with the Montreal Neuro and its experience in imaging, and that's really why we have chosen to be one of the four centers in the world that will have this new functional MRI. It's a magnet in the MRI that allows us to see detail in the brain. It allows us to give an isotope, or it allows us to watch what happens to the brain when they're reading or when they're playing a musical instrument. It's absolutely incredible. It was the machine that they used to look at brain injury in the soldiers who were injured in Afghanistan with landmines which blasted and gave them a concussion. So we're putting a lot of emphasis on the value of this of a metric in terms of measuring concussion, measuring maybe some innovative new treatment, and then maybe most important, measuring return to play.
They're two very nice questions about career, because students are interested in careers in the health sciences. So one student who enjoyed the speech, all of them did, I know, said, how did you become interested in being a physician? Is there something that triggered your interest? And the second one wants to know, how did you become the head doc at the Canadians?
Well, maybe I don't know whether I should tell this story in front of a dean or not. But when I was playing hockey, my goal in Saskatchewan was to be the next Gordie Howe or to be the next Rocket Richard. That's my dream. I dreamt about it every night. And I got to the point where I was playing hockey at a pretty high level, junior hockey, and I quit school. And, of course, my mother was devastated. And I played hockey, and I got to the point where we were going to go to the Memorial Cup. I was sort of a fourth-line center, a fringe player. And my hockey coach, whose name was Clark Burlingham, he played won an Olympic gold medal. He said, Dave, you're never going to make the NHL. He said, the best you're going to end up with is with a nice leather jacket with a crest on it. He said, you should go back to school. I said, really? What do you? And I grew up on a farm, so I wasn't very sophisticated. And I said, what do you think I should do? What do you think I should take? Well, he said, I would go to medical school. So, really? And he says, yeah, I'd go to medical school. It's a great career. And little did I know, he had an ulterior motive. The hockey coach on the University of Saskatchewan campus was looking for players that might be caliber that could play university hockey, and he knew if I got into medical school that I could play for 6 years. So they were in collusion, but it turned out very well. And in terms of, I'm sure all of you are maybe thinking about medicine as a career, and you're going to write a dean's letter. You're going to write to someone like Dr. Fuchs. So I got in, and in Saskatchewan in those days, they were changing from a two-year medical school to a four-year. Remember, they did 2 years there, and then they went to McGill or Toronto. So this was the first year that they'd opened up for a four-year, and I think they were struggling for students, or maybe they, because I probably would never get into medicine today, but I had the interview with the dean, and the dean's name was Wendell McLeod, and he was a McGill graduate, and he says, Why do you want to be a doctor? Why do you want to go to medical school? I said, well, my hockey coach told me that's what I should do. And they didn't laugh, but they almost did. And years afterwards, Dr. McLeod said to me, he says, Dave, that was probably the most honest answer we'd had all day. So that's how I got into medical school. How I got working for the Montreal Canadiens was that I was married and had a child, and I was broke, and we were being paid $135 a month, and my rent was $130. So that didn't leave a big margin to eat and buy diapers and things. So when Dr. Kinnear offered me a job, he was paying me $10 a game to go down and do something I loved to do, and so I could go to the Montreal Junior Canadiens game. We got $10 after every game as long as we could suture up all the players. So it was a win-win situation.
That's beautiful. Now I'm learning something too, because I never heard of hybrid icing. And this young person wants to know whether you believe hybrid icing is one of the solutions to fewer concussions.
I do. And hybrid icing means...
Tell me what it is.
Well, you know, when you ice the puck, it used to be the referee couldn't blow the whistle until the puck had crossed the little red line that goes right across the end of the ice in front of the goal net. So what happens? So there'd be a race for the puck, and two guys would come in, and one guy would smash the other guy into the boards. Now, in international ice hockey, as soon as the puck crosses the red line, they blow the whistle, and nobody chases each other. No. So, you know, you don't get smashed into the boards, and you don't. So, I think it's going to substantially not only reduce concussions but unnecessary fractures and injuries. So, it's a good question.
How do you deal with players who want to get right back on the ice or on the field? And another person knows about the icing rule. Hey, wow. This is an educated question.
It's the toughest thing that you ever have to do is tell somebody they can't play hockey or can't do. And I guess the most recent thing that I had was with Blake Jeffrey on, and you all read about it in the paper, so I'm not telling any secrets. But he had an injury at the, he was playing for the Hamilton Bulldogs, had an injury at the Bell Center, got hit with a skate right over his middle meningeal artery. The blade of the skate went right through the skull, and it knocked a piece of bone into his brain like this. And we were fortunate that in the we were going to suture it up, and we looked in and I could see that the skull was depressed and cracked. And while we were looking at that, he started to convulse. So we took him over to the general, and he got an MRI immediately. And Dr. Malecki, the neurosurgeon, took him right up to the operating room and elevated the depressed skull fracture, which was like from the heel, the tip of the blade, and it was or the skate, and just knocked in a segment of bone. And that bone was pushing on the dura and had cut a hole in the dura and was irritating the brain. So the seizures didn't stop until Dr. Malecki raised that flap of bone. The bone was fragmented in so many pieces that he couldn't put it all in, or wouldn't all fill the hole, so he put a metallic plate in. So Blake Jeffrey, and as it came through the college ranks, although he's a relative of one of the famous Canadian hockey players, he had a university background and he had a degree, so our counseling was that he should stop playing hockey. Because he'd had a plate in his head, he'd had numerous concussions, and it was one of the difficult things that you have to do. It's and I've had many of those discussions, but it really is a difficult. And I'm very sympathetic to them because I had a great desire to play myself, and it's the hardest thing you have to say to a player.
Can one ever fully recover after a concussion? Is that?
Yeah, I think the vast majority of people, probably 75 or 80% of people, after a single mild concussion get over it with no sequelae or no end result. It's the modifiers that I think are bad. If you lose consciousness, if you have a seizure, if you have amnesia, those are a more serious degree of concussion that we don't quite know how to measure and that we don't know how to treat. And that's where I think the long-term sequelae. Mm. And if you have more than one of these, and certainly if you have three of them, then it's a big-time trouble.
There's an interesting question. Someone wants to know, what are the kinds of things that the physiotherapists do, and how do you work with them as a team doctor?
Yeah, that's really important. I have always said that the most important part of my job as a team doctor is working with the athletic trainer or the physiotherapist, because they travel with the player, they travel with them on the plane, they travel with them all over, they know the player, and so they are often your best bridge in terms of communicating data to and information to the player. But they also can tell you, for instance, you'll get a call from the trainer and say, so-and-so is not right tonight after the game. He wouldn't complain of anything, but I think he's had a concussion. So they are your eyes and ears. And that's what I mean about collaboration. I think that's the, whether it's a nurse or a therapist, they're all a really important part of the whole effort in making this player better.
So it's not by accident that next week's lecture is on physiotherapy and occupational therapy. So all of those who are interested, you should all be interested, because it's all, medicine's a team sport, right?
That's really my message.
And that's very important. Now, there are a couple of questions that you can't look after, like the chances of the Habs winning the Cup this year. That's not Dr. Mulder's specialty, the betting side. Also, at least two people want autographs, not from you, though. It's from one of the players. He can't fix that. But one question that was interesting is, do different sports lead to different kinds of injuries?
Clearly. And the two sports that I've had the most experience with are hockey and football. And they, you know, in football and hockey, I think the big injuries are the big joints. Knee and shoulder joints are by far the most common. Concussion is up there in both sports. Soccer is a different. Soccer, the big injury is a knee injury. And I think rugby, you know, you can every and wrestling, you can everything cauliflower ears okay. to, but they each have their characteristic injuries.
One person wants to know and trying to understand why the second injury is so bad. Why can that lead to death?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to it, but it's a very good question. And why? Why, if the brain gets a second injury within 2 weeks, particularly in a younger player, so a child or a teen, or it's more prevalent in females as well. Mm. I don't have an explanation. It makes me think there must be maybe a biochemical trigger or something that perhaps caused spasm. They seem to have it boils down to a lack of blood supply to the brain for some reason or other, and I don't have an answer.
One young person wants to know about the player for the Broncos who recently decided to quit football and whether that was a wise decision. And apparently it was based on a fear of concussion in the long term.
This book, and it's an incredibly well-written book, is called A League of Denial, which outlines the story of how Mike Webster went from being the outstanding center for the Pittsburgh Steelers to being a demented street person who ultimately ended his own life. And it's an incredible story. And it talks about repeated hit. He obviously had many concussions. And that really was when they looked at the unraveling of his injury and looked at the examination, and when his brain was examined at autopsy, it was the first discovery or description of the abnormal protein that appears in the brain, and it showed a degeneration of the axons or the wiring of the brain, which we'd never seen or been able to measure before. Dr. Tatter in Toronto, who is a neurosurgeon and has really spent his whole life on concussions, He's now looking at this protein, and whereas he's looking at the pathology side, as the people in Boston are, we've chosen to look at imaging, and hopefully we can, you know, by trying to put the puzzle together, we can come up with some answers. Yeah.
A couple more. One person has read about CTE, and that the cases are usually described on postmortem. Can it be diagnosed during life is an interesting.
That's what we're trying to do, but we'd like to do that even before it gets to CTE. CTE, I think, is the end stage, and what I would like to do is to find some sort of measurement or some sort of metric that would allow us to determine that before they got to CTE and then prevent it or treat it. There probably is a treatment. We probably just don't understand, but. What bothers me about these brains that they've collected, they're so often people who have ended their own lives.
Yes.
in hockey.
Football.
Yeah, football particularly.
One question was, can you get Parkinson's from concussion? Because you suggested that might be one of the long term.
Just watch Muhammad Ali.
Right, and the point is that there's a genetic component, but that could be the case here as well. There's some susceptibility.
Absolutely. I think that's probably very true.
Finally, a very interesting kind of mechanical question. Airbags seem to be good to prevent concussion in the car. Does that teach us anything about how concussions might happen on the ice?
Well, I think it probably does, and what people are looking for is an ideal helmet, and the Riddell, which makes the football helmets, is a big commercial company, and they've looked at designing they put sensors in the helmets, but they put little airbags in the helmet, and they're looking at the ideal preventive helmet, and at the moment, I don't think we have such a thing.
Okay, David, thank you so much. A big hand for Dr. Mulder. If you go to a hockey game here at the Bell Center, Dr. Mulder is often there. You see him right next to the ice, and you can wave to him. Tell him again how much you enjoyed the lecture. So we're really delighted that you could all be here and Dr. Mulder was here. A brief reminder, next week, Dr. Annette Mainimer on rehabilitation, and one more lecture after that on the microbes in our lives. Thank you again, and have a safe trip home.
That's good. It's a great turnout, isn't it? Good. Yeah.